Up next, Dr. Carmen Bolter joins us. We're going to talk about her revealing an amazing new discovery in Egypt that you will hear first right here on Coast to Coast AM. Okay, welcome back to Coast to Coast. Dr. Carmen Bolter is the director, producer, writer of The Pyramid Code. Now, that is a 5-episode documentary series. Dr. Carmen is a retired professor from the Graduate Division of Educational Research at the University of Calgary. And here she is back on Coast to Coast with an amazing new report for us. Carmen, I'm looking forward to this. Hi, how are you?
Hi, I'm great. Good to talk to you, George.
You too. Now, tell us a little bit about this discovery, how it happened, what it is.
Okay. It's in Egypt, near the Fayum Oasis, and we've got some pictures on Coast to Coast AM to show you exactly where that is. Mm-hmm. And it's not new in that even Herodotus, way back in 450 BC, was talking about this place, and he said that it was on two levels, and there were 1,500 rooms in each one. And then as we went along, Strombo and Pliny and all these different people who were 500-600 years apart, so they weren't talking to each other, were reporting on this phenomenal underground place that was actually quite vast. And then all the way back in 1881, Sir Flinders Petrie did an excavation there. And so what it's looking like now is that there's four distinct layers. And, of course, in archaeology, older is deeper.
Yes.
And so the top layer is Roman. And the second layer was Ptolemaic, which is Antony, Cleopatra, and Alexander the Great. And then the interesting stuff starts. And so... Flinders Petrie did a full excavation. They got the top layers off. They found all kinds of mummies. I've recently come back from the site, and they found mummies of crocodiles. But what was curious about the Roman level is that there are wooden sarcophagi, and they have the painted faces of the person who passed away. And apparently those are among the oldest realistic paintings of humans. And so that's interesting, and all of that is in the Petrie Museum, and you can see that well documented online. And but there's some curious things about the site, because Petrie said, oh, you don't want to dig there because there's a canal over the top, and the canal has leaked, and so therefore it's just going to be a mess down there. And so in a way, he was protecting the site by telling people not to go.
He didn't want people to go. How deep are those sites?
Well, the stuff that we found, the bottom level, is one level is 60 feet.
Wow.
Right? Yeah, and the other one's 130.
That is amazing.
Now, did you look at that little video?
But covered with that much? I mean,
yeah.
How did it get so engulfed in being buried?
Well, until we... go excavate, and we don't know if we're getting permits or not just yet, it's kind of hard to tell how that construction would have suspended one layer above the other. We don't know if it's in the bedrock or how it would be there. So the Roman layer, of course, was shallow, and the Ptolemaic was a little bit deeper. So in 2008, they did some ground-penetrating radar tests and resistivity, but that was by laying cables on the sand and putting the electrical currents down through. And those scans came up at 5 to 12 meters. And it looked like there were anomalies. So you see the image with the greenish blobs. And you can also see the canal. And you can see Petrie's the site from his ancient text and how it corresponds to Google Earth and what he saw. If you're looking at those pictures, you can see to the south of the pyramid, he's noted that there were granite pillars and pavement underneath, and that part of the earth is quite, or the sand, is quite disturbed, because he was digging as deep as he could, and he was coming up with chips and sifting them, and he found quite a bit of stuff down there. So there is an open-air museum to the east of the pyramid, and the pyramid itself is 46 meters high.
Carmen, did you find that area to be safe?
Yes, you mean Egypt in general?
Mm-hmm. When you were there.
Well, you know, I've been there 29 times, and I always find it to be such a relief to go there, because, you know, they don't know what we're saying about Muslim people here, and that we're, you know, the all, demonization of all things Middle Eastern.
But they treat you well?
Absolutely. And you get there, and it's just such a relief because you don't have all that propaganda. It just, it lifts. And so we stayed like a block away from Tahrir Square, and it's got a wonderful energy now. Like, I'm quite impressed how they've cleaned it all up, and they put a nice monument, and you can just feel the empowerment of the people. It just really emanates.
That's amazing. It's amazing how it gets distorted here.
Yes. I find it quite disturbing, because it's a real relief, because even though I'm not watching mainstream media, you still get that kind of overlay. And I noticed that right away, so it's a real relief to be there. The people are extroverted and very, very happy.
Is it safer there than Baltimore, for example?
Yeah, I would say so.
Yeah.
I would say so, yeah.
It's amazing. Now, the Nile River, how close was it to those sites? It's quite a ways away, isn't it?
Well, you can see on the second picture that I found it on Google Earth, because the team that had been there before had driven there, so they didn't have the GPS coordinates. And so I kind of did a needle in a haystack, and that's why those two pictures are there, one of out of the book of Flinders Petrie and one right off Google Earth. But Google Earth actually has a ruler that has a it measures distances. And so it is 30 kilometers from the Nile. So when you think about the points made in the Pyramid Code, you know, that the Sphinx itself is 8 miles from the Nile. So the Nile most certainly would have gone in front of the Sphinx in the ancient times.
Right.
Well, how long does it take for the Nile to have migrated 8 miles? Well, this is 30 kilometers. You know, that's really far.
That's
so
a
to
long
me,
way.
That speaks of extreme antiquity.
What do you think happened to make that happen?
To make it distant? Oh, that's just natural.
Yeah.
But it's just in terms of, we don't think in terms of these long time frames. You know, school and everything wants us to be 5,000 years old, you know, the Quran, all of that. And so when we think of this extreme antiquity, it's really hard for us to wrap our brains around it. But I think we need to start thinking in those terms. And so, as I said, and it's the depth, it's the distance from the Nile and the depth that is speaking to the extreme antiquity here.
Tell me this.
And the high-level technology as well.
Tell me the significance of this discovery.
Well, if we keep talking about what's down there and how deep it is and how big it is, the area in question, well, first of all, it's space archaeology that helped me find it.
Right. And which is fantastic.
Well, and it's really cutting edge. So I met Klaus Dohna speaking at the Bosnian Pyramids at the Hidden Mysteries Conference a couple of years ago. And he was telling me about the kinds of things that they've been able to do with this space technology. And so it seems to be unique. So they're using live satellite scans, same as Google Earth, but what they've done is they've applied a program, software, that's quantum physics, and it's, of course, it's satellite-based, but it's so high definition. But the thing is that it can differentiate between bone, precious metals, precious jewels, oil, gas, water, pottery, and space anomalies, like just like empty space. And so each scan has a different signature for the different element. But this, and it's measuring longitudinal waves and using technically Maxwell's equation. But what it's the closest thing colloquially that we have is barcodes on things at the grocery store. That it's light that's being programmed in. And so what this scan can do is it can go 6 kilometers down into the Earth, but what most other scans cannot do is look through. This can look through things. And so most of the time, if you're doing this penetration, ground-penetrating radar, you hit an item, and that's it. That's as far as you go. You can't look through things. And so this is just astonishing what we found down there and the size of it. And so the area in question is 107 acres, which is 81 football fields.
I know. That's huge.
It's huge. And so 5 of the rooms are bigger than Olympic-sized swimming pools. Like, this is like burying an airport.
Well,
and I, I, I don't think that it was at the surface and that all that sand accumulated over the top over time. I think it was meant to be underground.
From the get-go.
From the get-go.
That's incredible engineering, especially then.
Well, it's the whole thing is totally mind-boggling. It's really hard to wrap your brain around it.
What do you think they used these chambers for?
Well, let's talk about that, because I mean it's going to be pure speculation, and what we've got with the scan is what I call a hypothesis. Okay, could be like this test is really reliable, and there's a lot of validity to it based on other applications that they've used it for, largely from governments in the, you know, that would say, well, we need to find, you know, diamonds. So they found diamond mines in Brunei, and they found gold in Bolivia, and they've even found 2 underground rivers in California recently. I think they said it was 170 meters deep, like that's, and they can tell the water flow and the exact depth. And so time after time after time, they're coming up that the scan is being verified by people going into the field. X marks the spot, and they're finding what the scan is saying. And so this is considered now, they're calling it spooky accurate. So if we really are going to see this hypothesis as reliable and valid, then, you know, we really have to consider why these rooms would have been as big as they are and why there's so many of them. So there's a total of 82 chambers.
That's 82, that is a lot.
That's a lot. If 6 of them, well, 5 of them are bigger than Olympic-sized swimming pools, but one is almost as big.
How would you get to each chamber? Are they all interconnected?
Well, that's the thing. If you really look at the scan, the blue level, which is the upper of the two, it looks like blocks that are as big as the farmer's fields kind of decided. And they're not connected. And the other thing that's not connected, if you look at the scan, the 3D animation that's in that little video, you can look clear underneath the levels. You can look clear underneath the canal. And so there's no, I call it snakes and ladders, going between the two levels. It's not like a tomb like KV-55, Ramsey's tomb, that's vast, 75 rooms that go up and down. So to me, it speaks to two, and then I'm going to add another construction, that they seem just the way the Ptolemaic and the Roman are at different levels, and older is deeper. It strikes me, by really spending a lot of time looking at this stuff, that they're separate and they may be different time frames. Now, on the west side of the canal, there's another construction that has these narrow passageways and smaller chambers, and there's a kilometer and a half of passageways, the narrow passageways. So it's like I'm not really sure what to make.
Do you think, did people live there?
No. I think it's like Göbekli Tepe, where that there's nothing indicating that anybody lived there, and there's 22 temples, and they've only excavated 2, I think. But they don't find any kinds of pottery or
nothing.
And so it seems that these rooms haven't been opened in a long time. So even Herodotus in 450 BC said he got into the blue level. I call it blue and red because that's the color of the scan. But he never got into the red level, and so he's just hearing stories from other people who did. Now, because they can see whether there's gold or not, there are 6 rooms on both levels with gold. So I don't know if it's on the walls or if it's actual artifacts. And so, it sounds like they haven't been opened in a long time.
Now, if Zahi Hawass were still around, would he even let you in there, Carmen?
Well, curiously, he hasn't been there. And he thinks, of course, there's nothing there. But did you see that videotape of the so-called debate between him and Graham Hancock?
No, I didn't see that. Oh, but I heard about it. That's the one where he walked out.
Yeah. So that actually, the reason that they were there on April 24th at Mena House was because Zahi was on the schedule to go to this site with Graham Hancock. And then they were going to come back to Mena House, and they booked this conference room to have a debate. And my understanding was that it was about this site. And so when Graham put his first slide up and it had the Belt of Orion, Zahi really took issue because that's Robert Bovall's theory, and he just wouldn't hear anything of it because of other issues with the three people that are in jail because of the scraping of the graffiti in the relieving chambers of the Great Pyramid. So all of this is very contentious, but if he doesn't believe in something, he just refuses to even discuss it. So, you know, there's lots and lots of chambers underneath the Giza Plateau, and I spent 5 years in and out of those. And he says, no, nothing down there. In fact, he cemented over a big section of that. So you'd be using jackhammers to get in there now. So Zahi basically dismisses the whole thing.
I would guess, Carmen, Egypt must be just loaded with areas like this that haven't been discovered.
Oh, yeah. They're saying maybe 10% of Egypt has been discovered, and since 1977, the first time I went there, there's very little new major discoveries. And this, because there's artifacts, or it appears that there could be artifacts in there, and because it is absolutely so vast, you know, this is a major discovery, but will they allow it or not? Now, we are in the process of doing Supreme Council of Antiquities permits, And there's 12 pages of guidelines for the application. And the first line is no new permits to excavate will be given in Upper Egypt. And then in brackets it says Giza to Abu Simbel, which is pretty much the whole of Egypt where there's sites. And apparently Hawara is exempt. And so, you know, these applications have to be ironclad with, you know, archaeologists from reputable universities, and it becomes a foreign mission if they're not Egyptian. And, you know, and people have done various kinds of permits over the years where perhaps you're doing a survey, but you're not doing an excavation. But when Zahi found out about the team in 2008, I guess they announced when they saw their scan, that's that lime green blobby one in the pictures, they saw anomalies that seemed to be running in even patterns, and so they phoned the press in their home country that picked it up, and then it was picked up in Austria. So it was picked up in Belgium, it was picked up in Austria, and then it ended up on a desk of a journalist from Reuters, I never say that word right, and he called Egypt to verify the claim, and he got on the phone with Zahi, and Zahi said, take it down, that's it, and he sent somebody to the site, and they kicked them all out. The archaeologist, the Egyptian who was there, was put in jail. The investigators were put on airplanes and told that if they came back, it would be the death.
And that was almost it for Zahi, too. Carmen, stay with us. Going to hit the break. We'll be right back. And our special guest tonight, Dr. Carmen Bolter, we're going to get into some of her thoughts about the pyramids. Of course, she's been to Egypt 29 times. I'm sure she's got some of her own theories. We'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM with her. All right, welcome back to Coast, Dr. Carmen Bolter with us. Carmen, you've been to Egypt 29 times. I've got to believe you've come up with some of your own thoughts and theories on how you think the pyramids of Giza were built, or all of the pyramids out there. What have you concluded?
Well, I actually have been liking the idea of a third-party hypothesis that that a lot of groups like East Indians, Mayans, the Egyptians, they all talk about their ancestors. There's pyramid sites that are turning up all over the world, and it seems to me that there was a unified field and a concerted effort to put straight-sided pyramids that were like energy machines all over the planet. And I think that they were put there before the Great Flood, and so layers of silt would have been deposited over the top, which would have then grown trees on top. And so that's what we have in the situation of the Bosnian pyramids, but also in Serbia and in China and all over. There's pyramids that don't look as straight-sided as they actually are because the trees are all different heights. And so it seems that there was technology and an understanding of what those pyramids would have been for. And we're finding, like, there's new pyramids being found all the time. And I'm quite fascinated with that. So I think it really had to do with the stabilization of the planet. And so, and there, you know, there's many more pyramids in Egypt than most people realize.
That's right. Are they still operating, do you think?
Yeah, I think so. And I think Dr. Sam at the Bosnian Pyramids really nailed it when he said there's seven different characteristics of operational pyramids. And there are some that weren't built in alignment. There are some that are flat-topped. And those aren't the same story. But I think they're all connected. And it could be that, I mean, I've even gone as far as to think that the third party could have been the Atlanteans and maybe whoever, you know, were their ancestors that gave them knowledge.
Might they have been extraterrestrials?
Well, and that's what's coming into question here at the site, at this site, because if, you know, how did it all start and what did they bring with them? And one of my first past life memories all the way back in 1973 was this evacuation committee for Atlantis. Now, what I'm understanding from reading ancient texts is that there were three disasters, worldwide disasters. So it sounds to me like Atlantis lasted for more than one processional cycle, like the 26,000 plus 26,000. And so there would have been enough time for Atlantis to be in a golden age and then down into the Iron Age and then back up into the golden age. And so during that time, there were natural catastrophes. It could have been an asteroid hitting the planet. Mm-hmm. So my understanding is that, I don't know about the first one, but that 17,500 BC was one of those disasters. And then 13,660 years ago is what the ceiling of the Temple of Dendera is looking at. And instead of the round zodiac, it's actually called the Calendar of Catastrophes. And it pinpoints the exact moment when an asteroid would have hit. However, because this already happened twice, and because of the sophistication and refinement of the technology, I think they were able to predict what was going to happen several years in advance.
Yeah.
So if, you know, you and me and 10 other people were on the committee, and it was like, well, what are we going to do with the stuff? How are we going to protect the people? Where are you going to put it? Right?
Yeah.
So if, you know, when I look at it, a lot of, you know, you can think, oh, that's like a temple, but temples, you start at the front entrance with the winged disc above and surrender the lower self to the higher self and walk through into the first hypostyle hall. Then there's another entrance, into the next, into the next, into the next, all the way back. And they're replicating the cavities of the human body in the temples. But if you look really carefully at this scan, this HD scan, it's like blocks that don't connect with each other. And, I mean, to me, that speaks to the idea of storage area.
How do you think they were built? Because even this new discovery that you were there filming your work with, I mean, we didn't have the kind of sophisticated tools then. Somebody had to have brought something to the table, don't you think?
Well, yes, and I think that we've misinterpreted all of that. Like even with the situation at the Bosnian Pyramids, this is just a little aside, but they found this bone, and it had holes drilled into it, and they tried to play it as an instrument, and nobody could make it happen. And then somebody from the Bosnian Philharmonic Orchestra picked it up with his left hand. It was a young bear bone. And when he put it in his left hand, he was able to get four octaves out of it. And this is supposedly Neanderthal, and so we're thinking that they're like, you know, the caveman with the big club, and he drags his woman around.
Yeah,
by their hair. You know, and that's just like, you know, one of those kind of, you know, metaphors that we've come to accept. And yet, if it's a left-handed culture, it most assuredly would have been matriarchal, but then it brings into all these things about artistic, and, you know, and if they have musical knowledge, and then they're doing all these, it's much more sophisticated than we would have thought. So the other thing about that is that for us in Canada, in the winter, if the grid went down, we wouldn't stay living in our houses. We'd have to go find shelter in a cave or something and build a fire. And, you know, we're sitting at the computer right now. But, you know, the next day, if the grid goes down, then our stuff is gone.
That's gone, too. That's right.
So it's gone, but we're starting over, and that's where they would no doubt have said, okay, this is where the stars are, this is where Sirius and Orion are, and we need to realign to that. So I think that we've created a narrative where we're not really accepting the level of sophistication that would have possibly occurred on the planet, but the tragedy that also would have happened through these various catastrophes. And so, you know, it seems that there were different stone softening materials that came from two different plants. They've discovered that in Peru, kind of like ayahuasca, but in a completely different way, that it won't work unless you've got the two components and you put it together and then it does what it's supposed to do. And I think that I've been told that there's some stone softening material that would allow, like the way Machu Picchu is built, that things could be molded. And then Joseph Davidovich is talking about geopolymers, and so poured stone, and the evidence of that is building as well, because when you see in the temples in Egypt, you know, the front face can fall off, and the structure of the pillar is underneath, and the fancy parts on the, so, and then I've also noticed, after spending so much time in Egypt and looking at pictures over and over again, that some of the molds of frescoes appear in more than one temple. So they could have had a mold and poured it. So these are sorts of things that we don't, we're thinking of them with a chisel, a copper chisel, against this big stone, and it's not how it is. Now, in the legends about the labyrinth, which is this site in question that we're talking about tonight, they say that it's a single piece of stone that goes over 1,500 rooms. Like, excuse me? How's that possible?
How is that possible?
We don't know, and so that's what makes it a big mystery. And so in terms of understanding what we have there, you know, I'm thinking about this this one doctor that I studied with for a year at the University of Calgary when I was going to do my PhD in archaeology, and he was in charge of the Queen of Sheba dig and all these different Arabian Peninsula patterns. So he studied over 3,000 years the patterns of disbursement of pottery technology over the entire region. And then he did a thing on 4,000 years of frankincense and myrrh trade routes, but over 4,000 years, right? So if somebody like him were to look at this situation that we've got, if there was to be an excavation, he could say, this doesn't fit with any pattern we've seen anywhere in the region over the last several millennia. Well, that would be useful to find out that it's completely different, right? But with his dig at the Queen of Sheba dig, I was actually a candidate on that expedition going to Yemen in the year 2000, 2001, somewhere in there. And then they blew up that ship in the right off the coast of Yemen, and then everything was canceled and we didn't go. But I saw the field work and the pictures and that sort of thing that they had done in years before. And so they used sand vacuums, very much like they did in Dubai when they were putting one of them on the barge, and then they dig deep under the water and they pull up all the sand, and then they made those islands.
Brilliant.
So basically, they're these huge vacuums. And so they would vacuum out the temple, and they'd go in with their little paintbrushes, and they would take pictures of one side, and that would be their field school for the 8 weeks. And then they'd go back to the University of Calgary, and then the whole temple would fill up with sand again, and they'd come back the next year, and then they'd vacuum it out again, and go on the other side, and they'd put their little paintbrush and take their pictures. And that's how they did archaeology in Yemen, is like literally vacuuming the sand. And so, at this site, I mean, to put bulldozers on top would be disastrous and imprudent, and then to have like 100 guys with their little leather buckets, as you've seen in various documentaries in Egypt, would probably take 25 years to excavate this place and also put it in danger if you weren't going to do it that way.
Carmen, Edgar Cayce talked about a hall of records at the base of the Sphinx. Mm-hmm. Have you investigated that, or your thoughts on that?
Well, I certainly have. I actually had a place built there that was, we called it the Hall of Records Retreat Center. And it was like a two-story flat with a rooftop, and it slept 12 people. And I lived there, in between groups, that sort of thing. So the Hall of Records has been really interesting to me. But you see, there's always things that they speak in metaphors as well. And so he says, under the paw of the Sphinx. Well, it could be beneath and in front of. But this site seems to be related, even though it's far away from Giza. It seems to be related, and so there's all kinds of things that where they say go into the, they go, somebody went into the Great Pyramid in 17 whatever, and they went halfway up the exterior of the north face, and the abracadabra sort of thing, and then the stone opened, and they went down, and they found all these huge chambers with pieces of technology and things that looked like discs.
And when you say discs, what are we talking about?
We're talking about things that look like they're cogs in a machine, like a computer sort of deal.
Okay. High technology.
Portholes, at the top, and they had the feeling they were being watched. But they went down, and they knew they were way below the surface of the earth, and they had to enter. But the long and short of it is that they were saying that it's the Great Pyramid. Well, that's all they had to do to camouflage so that people didn't go look where it really was. And so perhaps all of these chambers below have more to do with the Hall of Records, and there are definitely a network of chambers underneath the Giza Plateau, which has already been mapped, but no one has ever done an excavation there either.
No.
And as I said, they cemented over the top of a lot of it, but there's pictures from 1910 of the tops of the pillars of a temple of Isis that was down there to the left side of the Sphinx. So I think it took me forever to figure this out. But, you know, you read all these things and you take it at face value without realizing that a slight turn of phrase can deviate people to go look in the wrong place.
Is the place so vast, I mean, this entire region, that it could take hundreds of years to excavate?
Well, that's a good question, but I'm hoping not, because, I mean, I think it really has to be done efficiently.
I mean, you want to see it. You want to see what's happening.
Well, regime changes. Well, and some people say, well, just send boreholes down. And there is a device that goes with this technology that's meant to be walking around in the field, and there's an antenna on it, and it's more precise to say, okay, the chamber with the gold is right under here. And so let's go and dig the borehole down. And now there's LED lights and cameras that can do a full 3D mapping if there was anything inside there and take a look before you actually go and try to find an entrance. But, you know, most temples, pyramids, whatever, have an entrance. But they still haven't found the entrance to the Bosnian pyramids. They found the entrance to the tunnel system through this scan. I don't know if you're aware of that. This technology is what allowed them to start the excavation in Bosnia.
Just amazing. I mean, the ancient past has probably got so much incredible history to it, and you've only scratched the surface.
That's it. And because it's so deep, well, think about it. 1910 is when, you know, Darwin, Freud, Champollion, and archaeology started. They were probably all smoking cigars in the same salon. And so that's not that long ago. And so if older is deeper, it took them a long time to just start on the surface and go a little bit deeper and a little bit deeper. But, you know, the thing about the scans that were done in 2008 is they're really low resolution, and they don't show anything specific. And so now that we've got this new technology, and it's not that readily available, I mean, there's many, many different forms of space archaeology, some of which are more accurate than others. But this is what's allowing us to see. And they've done some things with airplanes in Bolivia and Peru, where they actually have a device that they can look from high up. And so they found all kinds of things down there, but there's just no time and money to excavate in the old slow way. And so, you know, that's why you need, you know, really up-to-date
sure.
people to be responsible for this sort of thing.
If you could do anything in Egypt right now, Carmen, in terms of excavation or research, one thing, what would that be? Carte blanche.
That's this. Go in there with, you know, 10 of these sand removal devices, and they give you 8 weeks if you get to do a dig. Now, you've got to remember that I've been looking for this place for 25 years. I've had past life memories about it, and then I had done this expedition into the open desert in February 2012, and we had to go in there with a hot air balloon. We had to have desert camping equipment, traveling light for sure, camera crew from New York, a Russian scientist with fancy equipment, Dr. Konstantin Korokov, and I had seen pictures of this place, and actually Richard Hoagland is the one that sent it to me. And it's this trapezoid shape that you can see from Google Earth with a big circle, and it looked like it had about 30-foot walls, and a big circle in the middle and an X, and then something that looked like a pyramid. And then there was a secondary site that looked like the Tree of Life, with these intercepting circles that had things that looked like aircraft. That's not unlike what you see at Abydos, the helicopter and the plane. So I got all excited about this because I also had friends that were channeling about this really old place that was really deep, and you know that we had to get permits to go into this military zone, and it was dangerous. It was a big adventure, unexploded landmines and all kinds of
yeah,
things.
Just what you need.
And a big hole like 2 feet across in the balloon, and and they brought four-wheel drives for the crew, but not for the balloon itself, so we kept getting stuck, so we had to fly in. Anyway, we get to the place, and it's all breaking apart, and it's probably about 30 years old, and it turned out that it was a target for the Air Force. And they literally built a cement pyramid, and they were dropping bombs on it. And so here we are with all our sensitive equipment. And the earth was just absolutely rattled still. And so chalk it up to experience. This place was not it. There was no way to tell without going to see. And so then, okay, that's 3 years ago. And I'm like, oh, well, that's not it. So after spending 5 years on the plateau looking in and out of holes and then going to this place that ended up being a wild goose chase, I had seen information about the labyrinth before, but I didn't know how it fit into context. And then all of a sudden I'm like, well, maybe this is it. Right, and so that's when I did the needle in a haystack again to find the GPS coordinates. The way I did it with the one in the desert was there was a little notification of a corporate name on the scan and a date. So I Googled the corporation and I phoned them up and I said, "Can you tell me where the satellite was above on this day?" And so they said Egypt, and I said, "Can you be a little more specific? Because Egypt's a pretty big place." And they came up with a scan. There was this teeny little pinprick on it, and I went and found it. So this was, a repeat performance of that. It took me 2 days, needle in a haystack.
That's not bad. 2 days.
Petrie, and trying to find the spot. And, of course, everything was disoriented in north, south, east, west. And then when I found it, I actually had the coordinates. And lo and behold, Klaus calls me very shortly after. I said, "Klaus, I think I found something." And he said, "Okay, well, send me the KMZ file from Google Earth." And 2 days later, he says, "This is the most incredible thing he's ever seen," because he's been working with this scan for a long time.
I'm losing you on the phone here.
Oh.
There you go.
Am I here?
Yeah, but we're going to take a break. We'll come right back.